Well, it's a great honour to be asked to give this lecture on the future of physics. Here it is here. I just hope that all the audio visuals work this evening. And as you can imagine, faced with a subject like this, one's immediate the reaction is, it's a very dangerous thing to do. Let me give you some examples of what might have happened in the newspapers of the time at various centuries. For example, if there was such a thing as the Vain Messenger, in 1600 it might have said, scandal of closure of greatest observatory of modern times, director absconds with 20 years of astronomical data. And again, nothing's new, of course. There was no political outcry about the closure of the observatory, just as there was no political outcry when the RGO was closed this year. So, again, nothing new happens. But of course, as everybody knows, within a few years, Kepler had, in fact, discovered the laws of planetary motion. And again, you might have seen these sorts of headlines, discovery of mini solar system about Jupiter, Ptolemy out, Copernicusian church unimpressed, the sorts of things that might have been said. Again, because of the discovery of the telescope, you couldn't predict that there was to be this sort of invention occurring so soon after the production of the astronomical data. 1700, you might have seen these sorts of headlines. England out of step with Europe again. Who discovered differential calculus? Experiment Crutius, unrepeatable in Paris. And there's a lovely expression which I use a lot when I'm giving lectures like this by Rizzetti in 1741. Following this discussion whether the experimentum Crutius was repeatable, it would be a pretty situation that in places where the experiment is in favour of the law, the prisms for doing it work well, yet in places where it is not in favour, the prisms for doing it work badly. And I invite you to select your favourite modern analogy for that same business happening. 1800, we might have seen things like this. Mr. Herschel's map of the universe. Star counts show that we are at the centre of the universe. Stop press. Mr. Thomas Young shows that Newton was wrong. Light is made up of waves. And so on. If we look at physics, it might have said something like this. Signor Volta's controllable source of electricity, absolutely fundamental. And then there might have been a little bit of concern about animal rights following what happened to these poor frogs in Galvani's experiments. And then I put a stop press there, Count Rumford, the well. Well, it's a great honour to be asked to give this lecture on the future of physics. Here it is here. I just hope that all the audio visuals work this evening. And as you can imagine, faced with a subject like this, one's immediate the reaction is, it's a very dangerous thing to do. Let me give you some examples of what might have happened in the newspapers of the time at various centuries. For example, if there was such a thing as the Vain Messenger, in 1600 it might have said, scandal of closure of greatest observatory of modern times, director absconds with 20 years of astronomical data. And again, nothing's new, of course. There was no political outcry about the closure of the observatory, just as there was no political outcry when the RGO was closed this year. So, again, nothing new happens. But, of course, as everybody knows, within a few years, Kepler had, in fact, discovered the laws of planetary motion. And, again, you might have seen these sorts of headlines: discovery of mini solar system about Jupiter, Ptolemy out, Copernicusian church unimpressed, the sorts of things that might have been said. Again, because of the discovery of the telescope, you couldn't predict that there was to be this sort of invention occurring so soon after the production of the astronomical data. 1700, you might have seen these sorts of headlines: England out of step with Europe again, who discovered differential calculus, experiment creatures unrepeatable in Paris. And there's a lovely expression which I use a lot when I'm giving lectures like this, by Rizzetti in 1741. Following this discussion whether the experimentum creatures was repeatable, it would be a pretty situation that, in places where the experiment is in favour of the law, the prisms for doing it work well, yet in places where it is not in favour, the prisms for doing it work badly. And I invite you to select your favourite modern analogy for that same business happening. 1800, we might have seen things like this: Mr. Herschel's map of the universe, star counts show that we are at the centre of the universe, stop press, Mr. Thomas Young shows that Newton was wrong, light is made up of waves. And so on. If we look at physics, it might have said something like this: Signor Volta's controllable source of electricity, absolutely fundamental. And then there might have been a little bit of concern about animal rights following what happened to these poor frogs in Galvani's experiments. And then I put a stop press there: Count Rumford, the well-known spy, demonstrates infinite source of caloric. Again, all of these are the sorts of headlines, the sorts of things that might have been at the time, and then look into the future, what happened within the succeeding years, and see how differently things turned out. And then finally, just one final example. And if I was doing this in 1900, here's what we might have seen. Professor Planck finds a formula for black body spectrum with new fundamental constant H. Derivation baffles scientists. In other words, it's how to get the right answer by doing completely incomprehensible and wrong statistical mechanics. The Michelson-Morley experiment was still a puzzle. Thomson had just measured the charge on the electron in the cloud chambers, and Marie Curie had isolated it. These are the sorts of things. And if you think then what actually happened during the succeeding 100 years, you can see it's an impossible business to predict exactly how things are going to go. So the important message is that I want to give you right at the beginning is that there are great perils in predicting what will happen scientifically. On the other hand, what all these examples show is that when we open up new ways of doing physics, and that means increasing the resolution of our experiments, their sensitivity, when we open up new regions of parameter space, when we increase the sizes of the data sets, when we find new types of physics, new applications of concepts in physics, we always find new things which get built in to the whole infrastructure of what we call physics. And finally, the other thing which we have to note is being aware of the relevant advances in the cognate sciences and then capitalizing upon them. Now, physicists have never been backward in coming forward in any of these areas, and again, that is something that will certainly continue. Now, let's begin by giving you my two credos about physics. In the first lecture that any physics student gets when they come up to Cambridge, they get me lecturing at them, and I give them, in the first sentence, this definition of physics. Physics is what physicists do. And that, I would hold, is the correct definition of what it is that physics is about. And the corollary of that is credo number two, which is that physics is extensive. In other words, it keeps expanding its boundaries, bringing other disciplines within its remit. Now, let me first of all give you the sort of traditional school and university view of what it is that we are trying to do. And I want to contrast that with what is actually happening when you actually do physics. So that, this was just to show you that physics was extensive, For example, here's the Watson and Crittick's example, where in the Cavendish they started off in the X-ray crystallography group and then that developed off into a completely new discipline in its own right. Whether that's still physics or not, I leave it up to you to decide. To me, it's still physics. We've simply expanded the range in which we can do things. Now, to get the traditional view of physics, there's just recently been an international review of the health and standing of physics in the UK. And it's interesting to see the subject headings that they listed for the disciplines to be reviewed. Astronomy and astrophysics, atomic, molecular, optical, plasma physics, condensed matter physics, nuclear physics, and particle physics. And that is fair enough. If you look at what we call our core curriculum in physics in Cambridge, and I'm going to use the Cavendish as an example, not because there's any special reason, but just because I know it backwards, and therefore can talk with more authority about that than physics in general, you can see that that is supported by the sorts of things that we build into our core courses of what we think every physicist ought really to know. So if you look at our first 3 years, there's the list of things that we hope the students will be able to assimilate, and it all looks pretty conventional. Classical relativistic mechanics, oscillations, waves, systems, fluids, solid-state physics, quantum physics, atomic, molecular, nuclear, particle physics, thermal and statistical physics, electromagnetism, optics, electronics, experimental, theoretical, computational physics. And actually, in the UK, we do this jolly well. If you look at the research, at the subject review of physics, there have now been 41 done, and there have been 10 24s out of 24, there have been 19 23s out of 24, and although you may say this, all this means is they've learned how to work the system, and they're certainly correct, it does mean that by some sort of objective assessment, we're actually teaching this stuff reasonably well. And I actually believe we do a good job throughout the country in doing this. But if you actually look at what we're actually doing as physicists, as research scientists, it looks very different. The program is very, very different from what we give in the undergraduate physics courses. But the important point is that you can actually do any of the other stuff unless you're on top of a very large amount of this absolutely basic stuff. I feel very passionate about this, that we've actually got to stick to teaching the core syllabus in physics, because with that it gives you the tools that you can go and do extensively all the other wonderful things I want to show you about. So what I thought I would do is to just use the Cavendish as an example of one of the large physics departments in the UK and contrast essentially what's on this list here with what's actually going on and where the cutting edge of the subject is from my particular perspective. Now, what we've done in the Cavendish, or rather I've done, is to organize the research into 10 major research groups. And these are pretty predictable. High energy physics, CERN particle physics, these types of things. Astrophysics, this used to be the Mullard Radio Astronomy Observatory, but now we don't do relatively little radio astronomy, but lots of millimeter astronomy, optical interferometry, and so forth. I'll show you a little bit of that later. We've got a large group in polymers and colloids. We've got a very large group in semiconductor physics, and I'll show you some of the things that we're doing there. Physics and chemistry of solids, thin film magnetism, shock waves, all sorts of things like that. We've got a large optoelectronics group. We've got a thriving low-temperature physics group, and I'll show you some of the things which are going on. A large and active group studying the theory of condensed matter. A microelectronics research center, which works very closely with Hitachi in the design and construction of prototypes for new devices. We've got an interdisciplinary research center for superconductivity. And altogether, we've got around about 695 staff. That's including all the research workers, all the support staff, and all the graduate students. And so this is just one example of what a large physics laboratory looks like today. Now what I want to do is to look at one or two of these areas and just pick out what they're actually doing and try to make some views about where the whole subject will be going in the future on the basis of the things which are going most successfully just now. So if we take this list, and I'll just highlight one or two areas on it. If, for example, we take high energy physics, I'll start with two examples where we're simply doing what traditionally physicists have done. In other words, going to new regions of parameter space, simply taking the old things that we've done in the past and pushing them to much more extreme values. And, for example, in this case, here are the various areas on the website of the High Energy Physics Group for the things which they regard as their core program. It involves things like the ATLAS for the Large Hadron Collider, LHCb, and so forth. So each of the groups have got both what you call the pure science, the involvement in large projects in this case, as well as the some theory in it as well. Now again, just this is one extreme end of the spectrum of how physics is going. This is a cutaway picture showing the ATLAS detector for the LHC at CERN. And our group is contributing the silicon detectors, which are going to be used as part of this enormous thing. And again, this is a classic example where one's simply trying to get to higher and higher energies. In this case, we've got a very clear objective. We've got to find the Higgs particle, or else we're in deep yogurt, as my Americans say. But although that's obviously one of the great goals, one hopes, in fact, they'll find lots more other things besides that. The lightest supersymmetric particles, other things that the high energy particle physicists haven't thought of. Now, there's lots of things that might be there, but one's got essentially a new decade, at least in energy, through which to explore totally new physics. And this is simply, again, the legacy of Rutherford, pushing to higher and higher energies. And again, at the moment, this is constrained by how high energy you can go entirely by technology. That CERN itself is in the billion-dollar range of experiments, and that's, as I'm going to argue, round about the upper limit that we're able to get away with, even if we play our cards as well as we possibly can. So there is an upper limit. But again, one of the skills will be to find ways of getting the yet higher energies cheaper. Another thing that's going on, the sorts of things which has now become more or less the standard for playing this game. This is another experiment for LHCb to measure CP violation in the B system rather than the K system, which we know about. And to do that, they've developed a 40 million frame per second digital camera in order to be able to isolate the events. Now, that's a pretty good achievement technologically. That's the sort of more state-of-the-art, and of course you can see where you can go on from there as computer technology develops. So I would call this just a traditional way of advancing high energy physics, and again, in this century, it'll simply be how much we can build for the given amount of money that we've got available. Let's look at another classic here in low-temperature physics. I'm delighted to see Brian Pippard in the audience, who again did so much at Cambridge for low-temperature physics. That's a subject which has actually been developing tremendously just over recent years. And to give you the sorts of examples of the physical conditions where we enter new parameter space, nowadays, Steve Julian and Gil Lonsrich and their colleagues, they're now able to study the properties of materials at temperatures below 2 millikelvin, magnetic fields up to 18.4 tesla, up to pressures around about 1,000 kilobars, and with high sensitivity. And when they go into that region, they're now discovering totally new states of matter. It's one of the most exciting things that is happening in physics. And what is happening is that you're having to deal with the quantum mechanics of large numbers of strongly interacting particles. Now, this is just one example. There have been papers in Nature in the last few weeks by Steve and his colleagues. And again, it's just another example of entering new regions of physics just because simultaneously they're able to get all of these parameters with controlled extremely well. Now, in fact, this is part of a huge area of strongly correlated electron physics. What it means is that whereas one can do rather well when all of these effects are relatively weak coupling, now you're dealing with very strong interaction between many electrons. And it comes up all over the place in many of the key problems in modern physics. For example, in high temperature superconductivity, which is one of the classic unsolved problems, one of the really great unsolved problems, where one's really got to solve this problem of the strongly correlated electrons, we will be able to solve that by understanding the new types of physics which comes in under these conditions. As I've said, we are looking at new phases of matter under extreme conditions. There really is a need for a new theory of metals, meaning that we need much more than simply a degenerate gas of normal electrons. But it goes much beyond that, because the types of new physics may well be relevant far outside the areas that we're talking about here. When you've got strongly correlated electrons working in these areas, some of the concepts and ideas may also be relevant for things happening in biophysics and elsewhere, where we're looking for new physics to try to explain some of these things. They will come up in completely different guises, but the types of physics may well be relevant in these areas. So these are two very classic examples of simply pushing to new areas where we need new physics. Now, having mentioned these strongly correlated electron physics, it's very, very sensible to look at the group studying the theory of condensed matter. And there, I want to just show you, again, if you look at their website, here's what you find that these people are doing. Now, let me, first of all, show you one example of the sorts of things which are now going on in the laboratory, and which indicate this another direction in which physics will certainly develop. That's in studying complex processes in solids and on surfaces using electronic structure calculations. Now, this has only become possible because of the development of supercomputers, but now you're actually able to do quantum mechanics for large numbers of objects using these computational techniques. Let me just show you one example that Mike Payne and his colleagues in the laboratory have done, which I find absolutely mind-blowing. This is a full quantum mechanical simulation using a supercomputer of what happens when you put one atom of aluminium onto the aluminium 100 surface. Now, I'll show you this and you can see what will happen. We'll keep our fingers crossed that all of the audio visuals are working properly. Here it comes. Right. Now, this is a rather pretty simulation. In which we've simply got a surface of aluminium atoms here. And here's one atom just added onto the top layer here. Now, in fact, the cell is around about this size, so this is just a copy of it there. Don't mention we actually have two of them. It's just duplicating on either side. But now, the achievement here is to actually follow precisely what happens quantum mechanically as we raise the temperature from 400 Kelvin, 500, 600, 700 degrees Kelvin. And the question is, how does that little added atom diffuse over the surface, according to quantum mechanics? So if we start letting this run, we start letting it run, and there, at a temperature of around about 400 degrees, you see things are perfectly happy. They're not sufficient vibrations to make anything happen, and they'll accept them to just sit there and enjoy themselves. And then we start increasing the temperature, and you'll see things start to bobble a little bit more on the surface, as they ought to, according to quantum mechanics. But you begin to see that as we wind up the temperature even more, which happens in a little while, we'll start to see the color coding is that things become orange or yellow as they come up above the layer. Now, at the higher temperature, 500 or 600 degrees, you now see that it's disappeared inside the surface, and another one's popped up from below. And in fact, it's moved along a diagonal. Was there, it's moved along this one. Now again, it's popped up there, but it hasn't moved there. What's happened is, one's gone down there, the other one's bubbled up there, and then it's over there. Right? So it's just moving along the ray, entirely in a non-intuitive way in which this is happening. Now, increasing the temperature again, we've now got a surface fluid. It's got fluid properties on the surface. We've got the whole of the surface behaving just like a fluid according to this kind of computation. In a moment, they remove two of the atoms to leave a hole on the surface, still increasing the temperature. And now you see, it's no longer fluid, it's become rather more solid-like again. It's preserved the crystal lattice, but there's the hole. You see, there's still the hole present on the surface. And again, you will find the hole behaves exactly the same as the atom did. It will actually move around by other ones bobbing up from below and moving along and something else falling down. You just see it right at the very end of the simulation. There it is, that one's filled up, and now the hole's moved to there. Now, the point of showing you this simulation is that this is the sort of thing which is the state of the art for using quantum mechanics to do useful things. And you also see that the things which happen are not predictable. If you'd asked me how things moved over the surface, you'd have said, wait until you get a big enough bump and it kicks it over on the next side. It's not what happens. with that of quantum mechanics, it pushes something up. That's the way surface diffusion works. Now, that's just one example of the sorts of things that we can do nowadays. And again, that's a beautiful example of Mike Payne's simulations. Again, he's set up a company to sell his program. And if you want to see how other atoms and molecules move over surfaces, buy his program. So, again, just to summarize what I'd say, the process of diffusion is taking place by pushing atoms up from the lower layers. That when we add the extra atom, it results in surface melting at around about 600K. The same process can occur for the holes in the lattice. And removing an atom from the lattice then restores the sort of crystalline structure that you see as you saw before. Now, what this is telling us is that now by using these supercomputers, we can actually do these large-scale quantum mechanical simulations. Mike and his colleagues can do up to around about 60 atoms nowadays, and that's simply limited by the amount of computer power. They've got wonderful programs in drug design where they're able to do these complete quantum mechanical simulations of how you can make drugs work and so forth. So again, there's a whole huge future for this. Now, I regard this as physics. This physics has been done in understanding these processes. Now, you may have noticed there are one or two other interesting things on this list of what happens in the condensed matter group. We've got, at the top, biological physics. And, of course, this is cropping up all over the place at the moment. And the big trouble, of course, is biology is a rather large subject. And if you look at what people call biological physics, then it means almost as many different things as physics means. But many of the physics departments in this country now are applying their skills and techniques to these biological problems. You'll notice that we've also got one little group here called Mind Matter Unification, Foundation of Quantum Mechanics. That's what happens if you've got a Nobel Prize winner in your laboratory, Brian Josephson, who wishes to work on these things. And again, he's there, again, acting as a stimulus for other members. The other thing I wanted to draw your attention to is this lot here on nonlinear dynamics and non-equilibrium statistical mechanics. Because that leads on to another of the subgroups within the theory of condensed matter, and that is the statistical physics subgroups. And one of the best publications of last year is this book by Thomas Fink and Yong Mao on the 85 ways to tie a tie. That book came out of research involving the processes of dynamics and topology of polymer chains. In other words, they're working in the statistical physics group, which is interested in how polymer chains work, their dynamics, and their topology. And of course, in the process of that, they had to understand knots. So they then classified all possible knots, ways in which you can tie a tie, and so this bit of physics gives you new insights into how you can tie a tie, right? Which is of great interest in its own right. Of the 85 ways, only 5 are any good, right? But they did find a new one, which, again, was not in common use. But the interesting thing about how to tie a tie is, first of all, it's excellent theoretical physics. But equally, what it does is it illustrates the power of knot theory, and it makes it accessible to the other sciences. So I'm sure more people will suddenly realize the real power of knot theory through this book than they will have by reading Michael Atiyah on knots, for example. This has got all the same essence of what's going on, and yet it's resulted from polymer research. As we know, things like knot theory are now relevant to string theory and everything else, and so it's a lovely example of the multidimensional way in which the research works. Now, let me have a look at polymers of colloids, having introduced them into the story. Again, that's something which doesn't appear particularly prominently in undergraduate physics courses, but it's a huge area. And I've only abstracted from their website certain of the topics that they're dealing with. It's absolutely a huge area. But under the topic granular materials, for example, within recent years, Athene Donald and her colleagues have been studying the physics of chocolate, the physics of concrete, neither of which are understood, because all of them are polymers and colloids of great complexity. And, you know, companies are interested in how to make chocolate which will not melt in your pocket, right? And that is a physics problem. exactly what have you got to do to the materials to enable them not to melt in your pocket, say whatever temperature you happen to keep in your pocket. Likewise, people don't understand how concrete works. How does concrete actually hold together? That's a very complicated process in the physics of these materials. Now, the sorts of areas that we'll be developing in this whole area, Athene and her colleagues are pioneering the study of what's called an environmental scanning electron microscope. And unlike ordinary electron microscopy, what you've got to do is to take your sample, kill it first of all, coat it, magnify it, photograph it. What they're able now is to keep the substances hydrated and alive, and then you can use the techniques of electron microscopy to study these essentially living organisms. What you've got to do in this device here is to have a whole sequence of different pressures within the same vessel so that you actually allow the electrons to not bump into things that they don't like on the way down until they actually hit the specimen itself. So what this means is that they are then able to do electron microscopy on real physical structures. And the sorts of things they are doing are absolutely amazing. For example, they're studying the physics of water chestnut. The physics of water chestnut is very interesting because, unlike most vegetables, you can boil up a water chestnut and it will not go mushy. Why is it that the water chestnut has got that physical structure which enables it to actually maintain its structure when all the other vegetables in the chow mein or whatever it is have gone floppy and messy? Right? That's a physics problem. So these are obviously interesting examples, but there's clearly also in this case a very strong link into biophysics because of the ability to keep the samples hydrated while they're being observed. Now again, and having mentioned polymers, the other large group here we're also very interested in these polymers is in optoelectronics. And Richard Friends and his colleagues have made absolutely enormous strides in developing polymer optoelectronic materials which behave like semiconductors. Now, this is one of these great success stories that they discovered this phenomenon, again, not by chance, but by discovering funny things happening in these polymers. And just recently, they've now got up to the step where these organic polymer semiconductor devices can produce more light power than traditional semiconductor devices. So what it means is that already Philips have got these organic polymers in their displays on mobile phones. Developed so rapidly, you get more light out of that as the backlighting for your device by this than you will through ordinary semiconductor physics. So again, this picture down here just shows the types of devices which have already been created. They're now going on to use the same techniques to be able to use ordinary inkjet printing to print electronic circuits. Once you've got these polymers, you can now put them into the guns of an inkjet printer, and you can then simply print an electronic circuit using that technology. Now, if you think of the implications of that for the electronics industry and cutting down costs, you can see that Richard is potentially a very rich person. Having already founded Cambridge Display Technology, which went on for a very large amount of money on the market, already, again, this area is booming. So, obviously, from the point of view of practical application, it's very important. But the interesting thing is, they don't understand why it works. Despite the fact that they've had this tremendous success, they cannot tell you the physical processes by which they're achieving these enormous quantum efficiencies through these all-polymer electronic devices. So you can imagine this is clearly an area where we can foresee enormous advances over the next little while. They're also doing lots of ultra-high-speed optoelectronics where you're dealing with femtosecond times, and you can actually observe various optical processes occurring in real time. Now, mentioning semiconductors leads naturally to the semiconductor physics group, where again there's some remarkable new physics to be discovered. Here again are some of the things on the website of what they regard as their major research area. And once again, I ask you to compare these lists I'm showing you with what's in the standard physics course. They look totally different. But these are all at the cutting edge of what's going on in these various areas. Now, once again, lots of remarkable phenomena have occurred. What Mike Pepper has succeeded in developing is a very large fabrication facility within the laboratory. In fact, it's by far the largest facility in any university department in the country for being able to get designer semiconductor structures in 3Ds. They can build things up on the nanoscale. It's really designer structures for semiconductors. And they're able to fabricate these things by having a long series of processes all in one swoop, kept under ultra-high vacuum, where they're able to design the structures that they want. Well, again, there are huge numbers of examples of what they can do, but here's one of the simple examples just showing what happens when you get down to very low temperatures, when you're able to get very single quantum wires. This is illustrating the quantization of resistance, which you find when you build a structure like this one here. And what you see is the resistance when you get down to low temperatures, totally dominated by quantum mechanics. We find the resistance goes up in steps rather than being a continuous function of the voltage. And the unit up here is in units of 2e squared over h, and so it's all entirely now related to fundamental physics. Now, one of the areas that Mike and his colleagues are doing are working on absolute standards of current and of resistance on the basis of this type of quantized phenomenon. Again, they can do other remarkable experiments. There's a thing called the fractional quantum Hall effect, where, again, one has got a 2D sample, again, in a strong magnetic field. These are Tesla along the bottom, and this is perhaps rather dull from the back, but you find, again, the quantized levels of resistance. When you take its derivative, you find out that the points at which this occur are coming at these incommensurate fractions of the field strength. Now, this again links back to something I mentioned earlier in the context of low temperature physics. Here, we've got extremely complicated many-body behavior of strongly interacting electrons. And then again, this again is absolutely the cutting edge of what we understand for these strong interactions between electrons in these types of systems. Now, I'm afraid you will have guessed I had eventually to get to astrophysics, which is my own area, the area which is engraved on my heart, so to speak. And I thought I'd just give you one or two examples of the sorts of things that we do in the Cavendish, which are slightly different from the conventional way that you look on what astronomy and astrophysics are about. These are the sorts of things that you will see on our webpage for what's being done in the astrophysics group. And lots of these will be the sorts of things that you would expect to see in an astrophysics group, things which are plainly to do with stars. But you will also see on that list geometric algebra, inferential science. And again, this is simply to illustrate the extensive nature of the subject. These things are studied in the astrophysics group because they came out of the problems that we had in studying the phenomena of astrophysics. In the case of the inferential science, David Mackay is doing incredible work on understanding the fundamental limits to information transfer, for example. And just within the last 6 months, he has broken the records for error-correcting codes by a big factor, just because the ideas came out of the work he was doing, again, to support the work of the astrophysics group. The geometric algebra is because of the enthusiasm of Anthony Lazenby and Steve Gull for Clifford algebras, which again is one of these things which happened because they came out of some astrophysical problems that we needing to study, and now it's built up into its own momentum. But the things that you will be more familiar with will be things like submillimeter wave instrumentation, star formation, the origin of galaxies, and galaxy formation. And I just want to give you three examples, because I love them, of the sorts of things that we're actually doing, but which have got implications beyond the immediate things that we're doing. So everyone has got this picture, extremely well known, the picture of the Hubble Deep Field. It's one of the great observations in astronomy. When I was over at the Space Telescope Science Institute 2 years ago, I asked the people how many galaxies they'd expected to see in the Hubble Deep Field. And it's quite an easy sum to do. You simply say, what is there nearby? Suppose the universe is isotropic, uniform, things don't change, how many galaxies would you expect to see? And the answer is 30 to 50. In effect, in the Hubble Deep Field, we've got 3,000 galaxies. It's one of the great pictures, one of the big surprises. And the big surprises came from the large number of blue objects and the large number of regular systems which are in this image. And that, what we're, in any word, what we're doing, we're looking so far back in time now that we're seeing the galaxies being put together. The blueness is simply a signal that they're making stars. Now, it's a wonderful picture. It's my second favourite picture in astronomy. I'll show you my favourite just in a moment. But of course, the big trouble is that if you look at the optical picture, then you must remember that in star formation regions, there's lots and lots of dust. We only find stars forming when they're deeply embedded inside dust. And so you expect them, you must take account of the fact that the optical light and the ultraviolet light will be absorbed by the dust and will then be heated up and re-radiated in the far infrared regions of the spectrum. Well, that's a very clear prediction, and long before the Hubble Deep Field was observed, Andrew Blaine and I had done lots of calculations to show why you should do all your cosmology in the submillimeter region of the spectrum, here, rather than here, because you're going to be messed up by the dust. And so, a couple of years ago, we got the world's largest submillimeter telescope, James Clerk Maxwell Telescope in Hawaii, and one of the devices which, when I was in Edinburgh, I was able to get going, a device called SCUBA, the first submillimeter camera ever built. And notice the link back to the high technology of low temperature physics. The focal plane detector array was maintained at 0.1 Kelvin forever, and it's got 91 elements on one side of the bolometer array and 37 elements on the other side. And we've got to keep it exactly at 0.1K without any fluctuations for periods of months. Anyway, that was achieved. That's this two-ton device there that does that. And we observed the Hubble Deep Field with this device. And there it is. That's my favorite picture in astronomy. The Hubble Deep Field observed in the submillimeter waveband. It's the sort of thing that I've dreamed about for many, many years. And the answer is, when you add up, it looks pretty crummy. You may think it looks crummy compared to the Hubble Deep Field. That's because it's only got angular resolution of around about 10 arc seconds, whereas the Hubble Deep Field is about 0.1 arc second. But the important thing is the total amount of energy coming out in this picture is about 6 to 10 times more than is coming out in the Hubble Deep Field. And it's telling us that indeed most of the action by which stars are forming in the early universe were actually emitting in the submillimeter, and that you don't get a correct census if you simply look at the Hubble Deep Field. So this is telling us exactly much more complete picture of star formation in the early universe. And of course, having got that, you want now to build the next generation of submillimeter telescope, and here it is, the Atacama Large Millimeter Array. And this is now, to go one step beyond where we've got already, we need a world array. So the only way that we can make the next large leap in sensitivity and resolution is to build an array on the best site possible, which is in Chile, in South America, at 5,000 meters. And you put together 64 10-meter telescopes, and then you do aperture synthesis, same way, the technique which Martin Ryle developed, in order to get the sensitivity and resolution to really study the details of how star formation in distant galaxies occurred in the submillimeter waveband. So that's why we've got a technology group within the astrophysics group which is studying detectors for millimeter astronomy. But we've just got another JIF bid submitted jointly between astrophysics and the semiconductor physics groups, because it turns out they've both got, in the end, the same sort of technological goal. This picture here shows a junction which is used in submillimeter detectors developed by the astrophysics group. And you put this at the end of a long column, and this is just a horn which focuses the submillimeter radiation onto that spot there, and then you then get an image. At the same time, in the semiconductor physics group, they were looking at terahertz technology, in other words, submillimeter ways of being able to study what happens to people's teeth. Now, you may not be able to see from that distance what's going on. This is a visible image of the tooth, visible image of the inside of the tooth. But what's happened here is it's now been studied with terahertz waves In this case, it's looking at the time of flight of the waves through the material. In this case, it's looking at the absorption. And you can see here, you're getting the enamel there, and the enamel surface properties here. And inside, you can see there's the cavity inside the tooth, which is being detected by the submillimeter waves. So again, this is the sort of thing that we... This is pure music to government's ears, right? That we build these devices in order to be able to study the distant universe, the star formation, and then we start finding people who have cavities in people's teeth. Right? It's the same technology that we need to do the two things. So we're very excited about being able to do both cosmology and dentistry in the same group. That's physics to me. Now, just an example again of the pure aspect of physics where we see this going. And this is just to indicate where you can confidently predict there will be a whole new area of cosmology which will just open up within the next 10 or 20 years. I think, as everyone knows, the Cosmic Background Explorer was launched in 1989 and produced the first map, detailed map, high sensitivity of the cosmic background radiation. Again, if you look at the sky at 5.7 millimeters, then this is the sort of picture you see, the whole sky. You see this absolutely uniform brightness over the whole of the sky at a temperature of about 2.725 degrees Kelvin. And again, this is the whole sky, the northern galactic hemisphere, southern galactic hemisphere, all on one picture. If you want to see structure, you've got to look at one part in 1/100,000th of the total intensity. And when you do that, you see that picture. You see again the plane of our galaxy stretching across the center of the diagram. Center of the galaxy is here. Well, we're not interested in the galaxy this evening, so there's the plane of the galaxy. Let's just blot it out. But the ripples away from the plane, these are at about one part in 100,000 positive and negative fluctuations. And these are real physical fluctuations on the sky. They are not noise, just instrumental noise. Now, I'm not allowed to give you a lecture on cosmology this evening, but you must take my word for it that I could totally convince you in the matter of 10 minutes that where that radiation originates is on a surface all about us from which the radiation was emitted when the universe was only 300,000 years old, and then it propagates from that last scattering surface to the Earth here, and we see it now. So as Herman Bondi once said, the nice thing about electromagnetic radiation is it keeps so well. In this case, there's nothing to get between you and this last scattering surface. And I've indicated schematically the little ripples that we see on the surface, which are the earliest seeds of the formation of the large-scale structure of the universe that we see now. So what it means is, when you look at the sky in this submillimeter wave band, we're looking on this last scattering surface, and it contains the earliest real information we can get about the structure of the universe in galaxies at that time. So it's clearly a very important clue to what went earlier. Now, I hope you won't mind me introducing a power spectrum into this discussion, but this is one of the most important diagrams in modern cosmology. It is showing how much power there is on different angular scales in the cosmic microwave background radiation. So COBE observed on the large angular scales of 10 degrees and greater and determined this bit of the spectrum here. But all our theories have predicted very strong effect that when we get down to 1 degree, we expect there to be a large maximum in the power spectrum of the fluctuations. If anyone wants to ask me the origin of that, I shall be delighted to tell them in discussion, but it will take 10 minutes. Okay. So what we want to do is to try to find whether there's evidence for these acoustic peaks occurring in the power spectrum of the fluctuations in the microwave background. Well, those of you who read Nature will know just last week there were some lovely results presented of the boomerang experiment from Antarctica, an experiment in which the balloon was launched from Antarctica, taken up to a very high altitude, well above the water vapor, and then it was allowed to drift around the Antarctic continent and then come back again. And once it got more or less over where they started, they brought the balloon down. And as great an achievement as anything was that it ended up only 60 kilometers from where it started. That's really clever. So the ballooning really worked very, very, very effectively. And what they were doing at that time was simply scanning a small region of the sky so that they could determine the power spectrum close to the peak. And you can see here the maps here at the base, the difference maps here is showing the areas where one's looking for these fluctuations. And this is the picture which appeared in Nature, showing this large peak almost exactly in the right place where it's been expected. And this is very important for our understanding of cosmology, because this is what we expected had to happen. If this had not happened, we would have been again in deep hot water, and we would have had to again go back to the drawing board and find out what was happening. Now, since this was published just about 10 days ago, there have been a flood of papers appeared in the net, and there are some very strange things about this particular picture here. Why aren't these amplitudes of these fluctuations much bigger than they are? A bit of a puzzle. And so there's lots more to be done to try to understand what's going on. But the observation of the peak was crucial. We've got our own experiment, which is just in the process of coming online in Tenerife. And this again is showing the sorts of high technology we've been developing to use our expertise in aperture synthesis, telescope systems, to again make similar maps of the microwave background radiation, but now again in Tenerife, which is a slightly more pleasant climate to work in than the South Pole. Again, I was using the techniques of aperture synthesis to get rid of the unnecessary backgrounds, and again the first results should be coming out within the next six months or so. Now, mentioning this use of synthetic aperture leads very naturally to, one more thing about cosmic microwave background. And the reason that this is a confident prediction that this will be the way that the science will develop in the future. The next mission of ESA related to this is a machine called Planck, and it is designed to be a 5-year mission which will simply scan the whole of the sky in 10 wave bands through the peak in the microwave background radiation and produce a really detailed map of the whole sky, from which we can infer the power spectrum and many other phenomena that we are certain must happen when we survey the sky with such precision. And I'll just give you a small comparison of what we think the new maps will look like once Planck flies. That will be in 2006, 2007. This is the COBE map of the whole sky, only with an angular resolution of about 10 degrees. With Planck, we expect it to look like this, where we're getting down to the very small, fine-scale structure, so we can get the power spectrum on very, very small angular scales and then define these peaks with very high precision in the microwave background. This is just a simulation of what we expect to occur. You'll see again the error bars are beginning to become tiny, and you can start to look for the detail in this power spectrum. Now, of course, my full expectation is that we will find something much more interesting than this. You cannot get to this sort of level of sensitivity on the sky without new things coming in. And there are all sorts of new types of astrophysics which I believe we will see in these experiments. I can describe these later if you want. But really, this is showing a new way of doing cosmology, the physics, with this background of the microwave background all around us. Look at things on the surface and look at things which are interfering in front of it. Now, finally, let's just look briefly at COAST, the optical interferometer, again, which developed out of studies of radio astronomy, the idea that you could build big telescopes out of little telescopes. John Baldwin realized that you could do the same trick for optical radiation and started developing this optical interferometer using the same techniques which Martin Rao had pioneered in aperture synthesis. And already this little device, just in the field at Lord's Bridge outside Cambridge, has taken images which are 10 times sharper than the Hubble Space Telescope. Now, this is only for very bright objects. You can't get down to the Hubble Deep Field with this machine. You bet you can't, because you've got to have lots of signal to be able to see the images. But here, for example, are some of the first images that were obtained of the binary star, the star Capella, observed by COAST. And here, the scale is 50 milliarc seconds there. The resolution of the Hubble Space Telescope is about twice that, about that size. So you can see they've seen the two stars, the Capella, again, rotating about each other at the right period. And this is true, this is genuine imaging. This is not just amplitude interferometry. In the same way, they've observed now the surface of Betelgeuse, one of the red giant stars. And here's what it looked like on the 11th of November, 1977. Then, a few days later, you can see these huge cells appearing on the surface. Again, this is not particularly unexpected, because these large these red giants are meant to have large convective cells in their atmospheres, and so we're simply seeing the material being convected up in these gigantic convection cells to the surface of the star, and then a few days later it was again back to its old appearance again. And although this is just working on bright stars, you can see that you've got the capability of imaging things you've never been able to see before. Remember that when you look at the theory of stellar evolution, they are all spherically symmetric stars, and what this shows is they ain't spherically symmetric when you look in enough detail at them, and you want to ask what effects are going to be caused by that. Well, let's just look now a little bit of nitty-gritty of what Michael suggested I might want to tell you about. How about economic and social things involved in this whole business? In 1997 to 1998, we were generating a research grant income of around about £8.9 million. And that's in order to sustain that activity that I've described on these overheads. 65% of it comes from the research councils, and I've given the breakdown of how that comes from EPSRC, PPARC, and BBSRC, the three major research councils that we interact with. 5% of the other resources come from government bodies, 14% from industry, 6% from UK charities, 6% from the European Community, 1% from other European sources, and 2% from other overseas sources. So you see that we are very strongly dependent upon the research councils for providing the resource to enable us to do the science. Although the message is clear that you go out and you find all the resources from whatever government funding or other sources are available to you. As well as that, we've got what I've summarized on this slide as sponsors and spin-off. In other words, we are being very strongly encouraged to benefit from our high-tech developments. And these are just some examples of the sorts of things which a laboratory such as ours must do nowadays in order to remain at the forefront. In the astrophysics group, I talked about dentistry, but another good example is the cursor system that Peter Duffett Smith is developing for being able to get an ultra-cheap version of locating where you are anywhere in Great Britain, much, much cheaper than you get by having your GPS system or anything like that, and that company is just about to again go on the market. Much of the work in polymers and colloids is done in collaboration with Unilever, who are very interested in the types of science we are doing, and in particular, they're interested in the brains that we've got in the physics department. Because although they've got lots of their own facilities, many of the people wish to work in the academic environment for doing the research. I've got the interesting situation in the department where the semiconductor physics group has got a very strong link with Toshiba, and the microelectronics research center is tied up with Hitachi. That is what requires a great deal of careful interfacing. In other words, they don't talk to each other. But nonetheless, these are individual initiatives taken by Mike Pepper to involve Toshiba, and they provide a large amount of the microfabrication facilities that we've got. And Haroon Ahmed in the Microelectronics Research Center has built up wonderful facilities through collaboration with Hitachi. In the physics and chemistry of solids, John Field and his colleagues, they have got strong links with DERA and with AEWE. That's largely because John has long been an expert on ultra-high-speed photography, and they're interested in what happens in explosions for obvious reasons. But although there's obviously a military aspect to that work, it also is of great importance for being able to understand how windscreens shatter, many things like this that are of civil application. I've already mentioned optoelectronics and the foundation of Cambridge Display Technologies, which has been a wonderful success, and you will see that one burgeoning. And so one of the other messages is that whilst we've got our pure science aims, we're also encouraging people, where appropriate, to take an interest in these types of activities. And again, we put no pressure on people to do this. It's just when it naturally comes out of the research activity, they see an opportunity to get a link with a major company, and then it's to everybody's benefit. Now, where are we going next? Well, just as of the present time, we've got a number of major things that we're wanting to put lots of efforts into. We want to build a nanofabrication centre to pull together many of the different things going on in Cambridge. We want to get in a much coherent way into the physics of biological systems. We've got scattered activity throughout the laboratory. We want to pull that together. There's a strong interest in getting interested in medical physics. We want to get on to the next generation of supercomputers. And we're also going to be interested in what's called spintronics, the way in which we can now build semiconductor devices which use the spin of the system as well as simply the electronic properties. So these are some of the more major things that we want you to develop. Well, let me start now just rolling this up a little bit and talk about the future of physics, the things which strike me. Well, I'll come back to, first of all, to another version of one of my first pictures. But what we need to do is always continue to find new ways of doing physics. And that can mean many different things. It can mean resolution, sensitivity, new regions of parameter space, the size of data sets, new types of physics, new applications of the concept of physics. So these are the types of things that we will continue to do. And again, this need to be aware of the advances in the cognate sciences. And it's particularly true of all the things happening in the biophysical area, in the medical area, in the chemical area, where we're now able to do the physics on these many-body systems and provide insights which, again, have not just been possible up till now. Now, let me look at four of the challenges that I see. Obviously, we're going to keep moving forward in all of these areas, but there are one or two things which strike me as being some rather more general themes. One of them is certainly this issue of complexity, non-linearity, massive non-linearity, and self-organized criticality. Now, the way that we see this most strikingly within the laboratory is in these strongly interacting systems of electrons and particles. And there, everybody agrees, there's new physics of relevance to many different disciplines. But part of that is it's just a move towards what I call massively non-linear systems, when we need to have a new sort of physics which is able to cope with these types of things occurring. And one of the things which may occur, which will be the upshot of all of this, is this idea of self-organized criticality. And it almost seems to me that if you look at this example of rice piles and sand piles, is perhaps the archetype of something which ought to be explainable by physics, but for which we cannot yet give any type of analytic result. That it looks terribly simple that when you've got a sand castle and you simply pour sand on top of it, it will take a particular angle, but no bit of physics can predict what that angle is. And the reason is that the way that the angles are set up is by avalanches occurring in the sand piles and in the rice piles. And again, this is a massively non-linear, complex system, and yet it results in some form of regular behavior. So again, already for mathematicians, there's a huge area, element of work getting on in this area, but again, I'm certain it is entering physics more and more. One of the other big challenges is how you deal with the very large databases and compare effectively theory and experiment. And I find this a particularly a clear example in the case of some of the astrophysical simulations of the formation of structure in the universe. Let me show you in this supercomputer simulation how we believe a large cluster of galaxies forms. Now, I use this example simply because it's close to my interests, but it could apply to any area in which massive supercomputing is being used to simulate phenomena. Now, this is one of the most beautiful simulations I've seen of how you make structure by what we call hierarchical clustering, how you make the cluster of galaxies by little things coming together. You can see, first of all, under gravitational collapse, you meet your tiny things, and then the tiny things begin to come together to form bigger things, all under gravity. You also see the law of equipartition taking place, where the little guys start to move faster than the big guys, just because you're sharing out energy between them. And ultimately, from what started off being enormous smooth backgrounds, we end up making a cluster of galaxies, with all the galaxies banging around inside them, and it looks beautiful. And that's our best buy picture for how the large-scale structure of the universe can apply. But when I look at a picture like this, I ask my colleagues, okay, that's great. How do we compare it with the real universe? How can we actually make a proper scientific comparison with something which looks right with what is actually out there? I think it's all part of this problem of being able to envision, to be able to visualize this problem, visualization of the data sets that we're dealing with, both from this point of view of how you can actually visualize the huge data sets you can get nowadays, and then to compare them quantitatively with the predictions of these simulations. So what people normally do is after you've done this, you then boil down this picture to a couple of parameters, compare with the observation, and say, reads well, that's it. And you know, well, maybe that's the right thing to do. But obviously, there's vast more to it than that. You want to make sure you know how to be able to do these large computations in the large data sets and compare them sensibly. A third challenge is the ability to use technology to reduce the costs of large projects to feasible costs. And one of the issues is, you know, what is the upper limit on what you can spend on a scientific experiment? And we actually know the answer. Empirically, we know the answer is a few billion dollars. Huh? We know that. Hubble Space Telescope went up. The CERN is operating, but the Super Collider isn't. And just empirically, you know, that's the sort of figure that you can reasonably expect that will be funded to be able to do big science if it really is important. My own view is that all of these types of projects are now world projects where we all play a small role. And you must take the decision whether that's the sort of science you want to be in. Do you want to be epsilon in infinity? Which is what it boils down to. But there's no question but some problems we will only be able to. And here are just some examples of what I'm talking about. The Next Generation Space Telescope, which is now being looked at very seriously throughout the world, is to build an 8-meter telescope in space. And these are various ways in which you might do it. In all of these pictures, this mirror is 8 meters in size. There, and there. And that's going to enable us to see back very, very early in the universe. And again, NASA have simply set out the challenge, do it for under $1 billion. That's what people are trying to do now. So again, it's a feasible upper limit for something which, again, everyone will recognize as being something of the greatest scientific interest. Now, I'll give you another example. And again, I call this with the need to be able to do new types of physics. And again, I cannot give you examples from the whole of physics. I'll give you just one or two examples from astrophysics. But again, the same type of thing could apply for any field. One lovely example is the OWL project. OWL is a new project which stands for Overwhelmingly Large Telescope. In other words, it's a 20 to 30 meter optical infrared telescope. And that's big. We're now up at the 8 to 10 meter class, and you can build that now for around about $100 million. Now, if you then simply scale things, how can you build a 100 meter optical infrared telescope? If you were to use the current scaling laws, then of course it would be unaffordable. But what the technologists are doing is to say, well, if you compare where we were with the Palomar 5-meter telescope and look at how much it costs to build the same size telescope now, we've got a factor of roughly 50 to 100 improvement in cost effectiveness. So if we start thinking about this problem now, and we've got the same factor of 50 in cost effectiveness, we can build the OWL for $1 billion. Now, you may say this is all pie in the sky. Okay, fair enough, but I don't think these people are talking nonsense. That there is a technological challenge to say, can we do these sorts of things, these very ambitious projects, for a price which is not unrealistic? And again, part of this is the fact that computing power is now so cheap relative to steel, and so you hope that you'll be able to find new ways of doing that. There's another example of a gigantic radio telescope, but then there are new types of astronomy, neutrino astronomy, astroparticle physics, and gravitational wave astronomy. These are just examples of new ways of doing astronomy, which I'm personally convinced will be the bread and butter, say, 20, 30 years' time. In fact, gravitational wave astronomy, I hope, will be within the next 5 to 10 years. And then, of course, there's astrobiology. That's the next three. If you really want to find out if there are people out there or other beings out there, then we know how to do it. We know how technologically you could find evidence for the right sorts of atmospheres on planets about nearby stars. You just can't afford it. So what you've got to do is to be able to find the technology, the ways of being able to reduce the prices to make that feasible. Well, let me then just finish up with a couple of slides. What are my concerns? I don't have any concerns about physics. Physics is fantastic. It's going to keep on being fantastic. I'm absolutely convinced of that. But the things which I really worry about are the gross underfunding of research and university education. Now, I suspect I'm speaking to the converted within this room, but one figure which I was interested to learn just on Friday is that the cost for which we are educating all students in the UK is 40% less now than it was 15 years ago. And you must ask, how have we been able to maintain our excellence in teaching and research through that period? And the answer is, we've been all working 50% more than our conditioned hours, and we've completely neglected the infrastructure of our laboratories and everything around us. And everybody knows that. And that is a message that has got to be got through somewhere. It cannot go on, or we're going to really fall behind. In fact, we're already behind our competitors within Europe. We need to enhance the attractiveness of the exact physical sciences. And now I've expressed this rather carefully, because it is clear that to us that whilst in Cambridge we are fantastically lucky by able to have some incredibly good students. They're all wonderful. All our students are wonderful. If they don't do well, it's not their fault. They're absolutely terrific. But we are lucky. And there's an opinion out there that the exact physical sciences, things like physics, where you've got to do your sums right, you've got to be able to put together the mathematics with what's going on there, really is not attractive. It's seen as being difficult and hard. And I'm not pretending it's easy, but we should make it attractive for people to realize what an exciting area it is. And again, as I've already said, we need to renew the infrastructure for doing new things. So let me give you my final thoughts, and there are only four or five of them. I've forgotten how many there are. Let's see what they are. That although I've concentrated upon where physics will be going, obviously many of the things that I've talked about have got very practical application for the benefit of society as a whole. And again, I'm not going to make a big play of this, but it does happen. It's a fact that happens, and it's happening in the Cavendish Laboratory, and I think all other places are really not just paying lip service, they are actually doing that. And I think we've got an excellent record in that. I feel very strongly about the intellectual underpinning that physics provides for all what I call the cognate sciences. And it's this ability to be able to take problems and mathematize them in a non-trivial way. That's what I've really written as my next bullet, the development of individuals with the ability to relate phenomena to mathematical structures in a non-trivial way. In other words, it's dead easy to go to any textbook and find a particular formula for doing a straight line correlation diagram, but you really want individuals to be able to look at data, to analyze experiments, whether it's in the social sciences or with the physical sciences, and actually do creative mathematics with them. And that's not easy, but it's something which is the way in which the best of the physics is certainly done. And then I do not believe that we should be bashful about saying that we do physics for its own sake. After all, half of our universities are full of humanities and social sciences. And why do people do it? They do it because it's bloody interesting. And nobody sees that. And we ought to be saying absolutely loud that we do this stuff because it's fantastically interesting and it stretches our minds and it makes us feel more creative. And I haven't yet seen that said in any government document. I think it's a scam. Finally, reasonable funding for research. I go back to the beginning. You remember I talked about Tycho Brahe in the very beginning. When Tycho was building his great observatory on Fen, he was given 1% of the gross national product of Denmark for 20 years. Now, if you compare that with the total amount of funding for all types of research in the developed countries, it is fluctuating between 0.5 and 1%. Now, we're not asking for vast amounts of money to support our research, but it does seem to me that getting that 1% figure and keeping it in real terms would do more for our science than anything else. Thank you very much.